This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello and welcome to The Country Hour this Tuesday. I'm Isabella Pittaway. Thanks very much for your company this afternoon. On the program today, plant-based meat alternatives are set to become a $3 billion industry in Australia by 2030.
Late last year, Coles came out with their monthly magazine, and they had this section that was just dedicated to plant-based meat alternatives. And I've never seen that before, but I'm like, wow, we have just crossed over to a mainstream, because retailers don't do that stuff unless they see there's meeting a consumer demand or it's going to make them money.
But what does it mean for meat producers? Also this lunchtime, coronavirus quarantine is slowing down wine sales to China. So what will the long-term effects be for South Australia's wine industry? You'll find out after the weather. And of course, if you'd like to get in touch with me today, you can text me on 0467 922 891. You can also call 1300 222 891. It's 12:06 on the Country Hour. First today, while financial markets plummet because of fears about the coronavirus, the opposite is happening in the beef industry. The Eastern Young Cattle Indicator record has been smashed again, now sitting at 754 cents per kilo. The EKI is now almost double what it was a year ago. Nikolai Belhart spoke with MLA senior analyst Adam Cheatham.
As we stand today, the EKI, the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator, sits at a record high of 754 cents per kilo carcass weight. And it smashed through its previous record, which was set in August 2016. And prices across the board have really just continued what has been an impressive run since the start of the year. So when we look at where prices are, particularly for the EKI compared to this time last year, we're over 350 cents higher. And much of that movement has come in the last 6 weeks. So some remarkable numbers coming out of the industry. Records are aplenty in the cattle market.
And it's not quite, but it's almost doubled over the course of a year.
Yeah, absolutely. The percentage increase has been significant. When we look at some of the reasons for that, obviously the last 2 years have been particularly challenging for much of the eastern seaboard in terms of those dry conditions. Particularly the lack of feed and water availability. And of course, now we have seen an improvement in conditions and an improvement in those feed prospects, particularly for winter. And that's the reason why we've seen, such a sharp increase in the last few weeks.
And so that is the main reason, you think, that rain and people saying, well, maybe now is the time to try and rebuild?
So I think we have to look at a number of variables. Firstly, our estimates for the herd are that we're sitting at close to a 30-year low. So livestock numbers are extremely tight. So that's one factor. And, of course, more recently, the improvement in conditions has really seen restocker demand spike, particularly in southern Queensland and northern New South Wales, where the majority of that livestock has been, but also where conditions have been the worst in the last 2 years. So a combination of factors have seen prices move higher. And another variable has been a strong lot feeding sector in the last 2 years, which has helped support beef production, looks to be remaining strong. So that competition between the lot feeding sector and restockers looking to take young cattle back to the paddock has been particularly strong in the last few weeks.
So does that say something about the confidence that those producers are feeling in some of those areas that have got rain, I guess?
Most certainly, I think. Given that the last 2 years, now that these restockers have got feed in front of them, it's given them the incentive to buy back into the market and try and restock those paddocks. I think some of the initial increases will have been driven by some uncertainty as to where prices could have moved. Mm. Certainly an expectation that in the early weeks of those price rises that it would go higher. So restockers were certainly looking to buy into the market. But there's certainly confidence. I think there's certain areas which still need further rainfall. And I think when we look at the medium to long-term prospects for the Eki, certainly certain areas, particularly in the south, do need some follow-up rain to keep the momentum. But certainly in those parts of southeast Queensland that have got that seasonal break, there's certainly a renewed confidence.
Obviously, it's very hard to predict what may happen next. But given that we've seen such a big run of prices up, is at some point, does there have to be a kind of a natural cap to the market where people say, well, it doesn't actually make sense to push prices any higher? It doesn't check out financially?
Yeah, there will absolutely be a ceiling. And I think whether we're getting close to that, I'm not too sure. But certainly for those restockers purchasing young livestock at these prices, they need to assess, of course, what the finished returns will be in whatever 6 to 12 months' time, or for those lot feeders who are inducting those cattle on feed programs, what the finished returns might be. And, of course, we've started to see a disconnect between young prices and finished prices as a result of those sharp increases. So certainly I think we're getting to a stage where there needs to be some assessment from producers as to where prices might be heading. And I think when we look towards some of our competitors, we've actually started to see some of their prices start to ease off. And I think that is of course, being driven by some of those global factors and global fundamentals that we've seen in the market at the moment.
Yeah, and one of those global factors is the word that everybody's talking about at the moment in coronavirus. Because I guess that one of the potentials is that some big buyers of our beef, demand could drop from them if they're not able to physically get those containers and those shipments across.
Well, we're starting to see reports and indications now of that demand across some of Australia's key markets. I think obviously China has been the headline for the last 12 to 18 months, particularly the strong demand last year. And of course, with the impact of coronavirus, we've started to see some trade disruption, not only in terms of access to ports and getting products into the country, but given some of the restrictions and controls in the market, we're starting to see demand ease off in certain chains, whether that's food service or retail. But looking broader to some of Australia's key markets, whether that's Japan or Korea or China, we're seeing an economic slowdown now, and we're seeing the impact on tourism and normal trade flows. So there's certainly some uncertainty in the market, and I think, of course, the global stock markets more recently do reflect that uncertainty. And naturally, Australian beef will be a component of that. So there is going to be a disparity between those young prices and finished prices, particularly with that uncertainty in the market. And ultimately, nobody knows where this is going to end up.
That is MLA Senior Analyst Adam Cheatham. There's growth also in alternative meats as well, because plant or fake meat is already a $50 million industry in Australia, and it's going to be worth billions within the decade. That's according to research by major accountancy and economic firm Deloitte. And as the fake meat category rises, Australia is being urged to get behind the production of the product or risk being left behind. Warwick Long spoke to Joe Jericho, Senior Manager at Monitor Deloitte, who says although plant-based meat is becoming more popular, it isn't all bad news for products like beef.
It's actually quite surprising doing this research to see just how big it is. So it's 150 million, of which 35 million of that is in the food service. So, grilled, Lord of the Fries, now Hungry Jack's. And then the other 115 million is in grocery channels like Coles and Woolworths. But 150 million, that's actually really substantial.
So when you're talking about the grocery channels, that's us walking into the supermarket. There's always been the traditional sort of lamb, beef, chicken sections. And now there's an ever-growing plant-based meat section of a supermarket.
Yeah, and if you see, they're actually starting to put it in actually the meat cases themselves. And late last year, Coles came out with their monthly magazine, and they had this section that was just dedicated to plant-based meat alternatives. And I've never seen that before, but I'm like, wow, we have just crossed over to a mainstream, because retailers don't do that stuff unless they see there's meeting a consumer demand or it's going to make them money.
So we've been through this incredibly quick growth phase. We're at 150 million now. Is it going to continue to grow?
Yeah, we think so. So we've done modelling across to 2030, and there are three future scenarios that we think are possible. Probably the most likely one is that it would actually generate $1 billion in value add. Now, that's value add for GDP. So the equivalent is actually $3 billion in growth in sales, which is across your grocery and food service. Now, that's a really substantial growth, but it's coming from a really small base. And if you look at some of the other consumer trends that are driving this, it's totally possible.
So it could become a $3 billion industry. And you're saying that's the most likely scenario?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this still requires some things to go right. Like, it still requires R&D innovation. It would probably require, you know, consumers to continue to embrace this. But yeah, it's absolutely a possibility and a likely possibility.
So who's eating it? Who's eating this product? Have you looked at that?
We all are. So we're seeing a growth in vegetarian, but also in flexitarian and reducitarians as well.
And what do you mean by those titles?
So flexitarians are people who predominantly eat plant-based foods and then occasionally supplement that with meat. Reducitarians are just people who've always eaten meat and are just trying to eat less. So I'd probably say I'm somewhere myself between a reducitarian, a flexitarian, and I've moved to a wagon Wednesday. I eat plant-based 6 days a week, except for on a Wednesday where I'm like, I'm eating meat and it's got to be very good. So I'm picking out and selecting, you know, something that I've been craving all week, a great steak or a beautiful burrito or something that's just perfect.
People who are doing that, is that due to their beliefs about climate change or is it their beliefs about animal welfare? Did you go into that detail?
So there's probably three main drivers for it. One is sustainability. So, you know, just the environmental impact of animals on the environment. The second one's the ethical side of things. So the animal welfare. And then the third reason is about health. If you think about the highest causes of killers in Australia, it's diabetes, it's heart disease, it's cancers, which we know are reduced when you have a plant-based diet.
I suppose then that just leaves, like, we're $150 million now, could be up to a $3 billion industry. Well, it's likely it becomes a $3 billion industry. Who are the major players in this? Are we talking startups? Are we talking major companies? Who's getting involved in plant-based meat?
Yeah, it's a combination. So there's been some startups, but what you're seeing now is that the big major FMCG companies are making investments in these startups, or they've created their own little incubator companies. And so they can see the future, and they're like, we're not quite sure how this is going to play out, but we're going to be a part of it. So you'll see there'll be companies that you're not quite familiar with their name, but they'll probably have backing by some very big names. The other one, for example, you would have seen recently with Hungry Jack's making investments in terms of launching a plant-based patty.
So we're going to see more and more of that.
More and more of that, yeah.
By when are you looking at it being a $3 billion industry?
So 2030, 10 years' time.
Which really isn't that far away, is it?
No, but I think you can see that we talked about, you can see the impacts and the changes happening now. I think probably the key thing I'd highlight is that the plant-based meat alternatives are not coming necessarily at a global level at a negative impact on beef. I think that the opportunity that Australia has and a total market is that we need to feed a global economy, and Australia is well placed to do that.
And is it likely then that plant-based protein is going to be produced in Australia or elsewhere in the world and imported?
This is the opportunity, right? So ideally we want it produced in Australia so that we take advantage of it and we own our story.
That's Joe Jericho, Senior Manager at Monitor Deloitte, the strategy arm of the major accountancy and economic firm Deloitte, speaking there to Warwick Long. Still to come on the Country Hour, the coronavirus continues to slow down Aussie wine sales to China.
Around about a third of all wine sales in China are on-premise sales. So, you know, anyone that's dining out or wanted to dine out has had pretty severe restriction placed on them. So not only impacting wine, but it will be impacting a lot of other ag export products right across the chain.
That story is coming up after the weather. Right now, though, it is 19 past 12 on the Country Hour, and we're going to head to the southeast because not everyone's happy about the new lobster processing facility to be built at Beachport. Yesterday, I spoke about how the Limestone Coast Fishing Co-op received state government funding to help build the facility, which will help maintain the quality of the lobsters caught by co-op fishermen in the northern end of the fishing zone. Well, processor Sky Seafood's Andrew Laurie says the funding gives the co-op an unfair advantage over other businesses.
When you consider there's already eight other exporting factories in the southeast, and four of them are community-owned by local fishing families, it just seems an unfair leg up for somebody to be given the money to set the business up.
Do you feel that there is simply enough capacity as it exists to store the lobster that is currently being caught, or the quota that exists at the moment?
Well, the quota is at its lowest it's been for 15 years. It's very sustainable, mind you. The live facilities have held those lobsters for the years gone by, so nothing's changed.
Governments do give grants quite commonly to private businesses. It is something we do see from time to time, particularly for expanding industries. How is this any different?
This is actually direct competition against those already that have used their own funds to set up their facilities. The government just seems to be saying, okay, we'll let you set up a facility. Here's the money to do it with. Whereas we've all had to put our hands in our own pockets as small businesses to do this over the years.
As I mentioned, you're the owner of Sky Seafoods. Has your company ever sought or received a government grant to run the business?
No. We received a $6,000 grant one time to do a trade fair in Shanghai, assistance for extra marketing. But no, we've never received assistance to set up infrastructure and our business facility with our holding tanks.
As the new facility is being built at Beachport, it's expected to be up and running by the next fishing season. I mean, what could it mean for your business? What are your concerns about what it could mean potentially for what you do?
Oh no, I've got no fears, or I'm not saying that the competition is not good and it's not allowed to happen. That's for sure. Yeah, the fishermen have every right. These fishermen have every right to set up their own facility. But all I'm saying is that a community-funded facility, and it's not for community use, it's for a private use, for a private business. The funding is what I'm objecting to.
Is this something that you've raised with your local MP or intend to do so?
I've raised it with our local MP, and I've raised it with the Minister and the Premier's office, and I sent a letter to the opposition when we found out that the grant was a done deal on behalf of the 8 exporters in the southeast, and as I said, 4 of them are family-owned companies.
Have you received any response as yet?
Not from the opposition, and probably won't, I suppose, because it's already a done deal. But Minister Whetstone said that he consulted with other processors on the coast. As I said, the 8 other exporters on the coast that I spoke to haven't heard from his office or him.
Now, it has been some time since we checked in with you. Obviously, things ongoing and continuing to change moment from moment with the coronavirus. I mean, how are things going given that this is sort of stretched now into quite a few weeks where there's been no exports into China? How are things holding up?
No, that's pretty hard. Most of the fishers that have still got quota have actually stopped fishing. Oh, here, Tasmania, they've just started, so the volume coming out of there will definitely ensure that there's no price in China for a long time yet, and there's not many restaurants even open yet to even send fish into.
Big effects for the seafood industry as well with the coronavirus. That was Sky Seafood's Andrew Laurie speaking there to Selena Green. Let's head off to the markets now, and with the results from the Dublin sheep market today, here's John Traeger.
Good afternoon. Quality was fairly good as agents offered 9,000 lambs and 2,500 sheep to the usual array of trade and processor buyers, specialty butchers and restockers. Competition was somewhat erratic, with early sales easing marginally as later sales lifted in places by up to $10 a head and then drifting lower toward the close of the sale. Extremely light young lambs sold from $78 to $110. Light young lambs received $110 to $138. Light trade weights made 128 to 164, with the few heavyweights making $185 to $190 per head. Extremely light older lambs range from 110 to 152. Light weights made 145 to 160. Light trade weights sold from 140 to 172. Medium weights received 184 to 202, as heavy trade lambs made $225 to $290. The few extreme heavyweights on offer sold from $320 to $348 per head, or close to $9.30 a kilo. Light hoggets sold from $102, with heavier weights receiving $214 to $220. Ewe mutton of mostly heavier weights sold from $180 to $234 and up by $10 per head, with wether mutton again of mostly heavier weights receiving $180 to $234 per head. an extremely mixed selection of rams sold from $130 to a top of $228 per head. This is John Traeger at the South Australian Livestock Exchange for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service and the Country Hour.
Thanks, John. And there was a new sale yard record made today at Dublin, with the 99 Suffolk Cross lambs selling for $348 a head. Let's get to the Weather Bureau now, and it's good afternoon to senior forecaster Tom Bowick. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Isabella.
What's happening today?
Okay, well, there's not a great deal happening during today. Mostly the state is dry. There has been some very isolated thunderstorm activity in the west of the state, so areas to the west of about, say, Ceduna to Cooper Pedy and up to Ernabella at the far in the far north there, there's been some very isolated thunderstorm activity through that area, but I suspect probably not producing much in the way of any significant rainfall. Been dry throughout the remainder of the state, and it's likely to remain similar to that for the rest of Tuesday there. Maybe still a little bit of that activity developing, in, or should I say continuing in the west there, and possibly near the eastern border of the northeast pastoral district, we could see some convective clouds building up through that area and a possibility of a shower sort of later in this afternoon, but not a great deal in it. Now, as we move into Wednesday then, we get a low pressure trough and associated low pressure system actually developing near the western border sort of overnight tonight and into early Wednesday. And that will see a little bit more activity around tomorrow, but a chance of a shower or possible thunderstorm over western parts of the state and a bit of humidity creeping down into the east of the state as well. So I think the central parts of the state will sort of remain dry. So through the sort of central district, Adelaide Metro, York Peninsula sort of area, Kangaroo Island should be remaining dry. But to the east of the ranges there, there is a bit of moisture coming in. Could see a chance of a shower through that area, particularly for the afternoon and evening. Maybe even a rumble of thunder if you're in the southeast district. Now, temperatures will also be sort of on the rise on Wednesday as winds turn a bit more northerly, and particularly on Thursday as well, with that low pressure system moving eastwards, the low expected to be centred sort of west of Kangaroo Island later on Thursday. And there'll be some moisture coming down ahead of that low pressure system, so through sort of central parts of the pastoral districts and generally over the agricultural area, a slight to medium chance of some shower activity, possibly a rumble of thunder as well, but not expecting too much in the way of rainfall really out of any of that. Northerly winds will be picking up somewhat in the west as well, so we could see some areas of raised dust as well developing through those western parts. Now on Friday, there is a change going to be moving through as that low pressure system moves southeastwards. The low will be centred to the southeast of our state in the early hours of Friday morning. So a chance of a thunderstorm sort of in the southeast districts early on Friday morning as the low sort of moves away, and just a slight chance of shower activity for the southern agricultural area sort of persisting on Friday in the wake of the change. And speaking of that change, expecting the winds will be picking up following the change during the day on Friday. So we'll end up with a fresh south-southeasterly airstream, possibly even strong and gusty in parts, with quite a strong high building to the southwest of the bight there. That high will then be moving eastwards slowly through the weekend, but probably relatively windy start to the start of the weekend. Now, the rainfall totals for the next few days, not expecting a lot, but yeah, there is a possibility of some rainfalls up to about 2 millimetres, and maybe if you do happen to have a thunderstorm, there could be some falls of 2 to 5 millimetres. So that's about it from me. Back to you, Isabella.
All righty. Thanks, Tom.
No worries.
Tom Bowick there at the Weather Bureau. Let's look at the far west of New South Wales now. And for the upper western district, tomorrow will be mostly sunny in the morning, then a slight chance of a shower or thunderstorm in the afternoon and early evening. Overnight, it'll be between 18 and 21, and then getting up to around 30 degrees. For the lower western district, it'll be a partly cloudy day. Again, a slight chance of a shower or thunderstorm in the west in the afternoon. Overnight, dropping to 18, and then getting up again. Very similar weather to a top of 30 degrees. Still to come on the Country Hour, we are looking at the wine industry and just how it's dealing with sales being down because of the coronavirus. That's still to come.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Isabella Pittaway.
Hello, great to be with you this Tuesday afternoon. Very soon, we're going to be talking about the ongoing effects of coronavirus for Australia's wine industry as quarantine puts a dampener on restaurant sales. Plus, how much do you know about the industry that produces the food that you feed your pets? You're going to hear from someone whose job it is to find ingredients used to feed cats and dogs all over the world. Also this lunchtime, we're going to be talking about the art of blade shearing.
There is something about blade shearing. The sheep are a lot calmer. We quite often get guys that machine shear, have never seen blade shearing, and when they do for the first time, can't believe how calm and well the sheep sit. They literally, like, fall asleep.
That story a little later in the program. Right now, though, it is just after 12:30 with the latest in news headlines. It's good afternoon to Matt Coleman.
Hello, Isabella. The Industrial Relations Minister, Christian Porter, says the federal government needs to determine the scale of the coronavirus impact before it can make a decision about any compensation for casual and contract workers. Mr. Porter has met unions and employer groups in Sydney today to discuss workplace issues linked to coronavirus. Unions want casual workers to be paid if they're forced to miss work because they're in quarantine. A drive-through coronavirus testing clinic has opened in South Australia in what's believed to be a first for the country's public health system. The clinic is expected to receive a patient every 20 minutes once fully operational. Patients in need of a test will require a referral from their GP before they can attend the drive-through, which has been set up at the former Repat Hospital site in Adelaide's inner southern suburbs. And the state government has awarded contracts to four operators to provide bus and tram services in Adelaide. The outer northeast, east, west and outer north public transport routes will be run by Torrens Transit, the North-South Light Rail will be run by Torrens Connect, and Keilios Downer will run hill services, and the Outer South Bus routes will be run by Busways South Australia. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Matt. It is 28 minutes to 1. If you want to send me a text, we love hearing from you, 0467 922 891. You can also join the conversation today by calling 1300 222 891. We're going to stay on the issue of the coronavirus because it's continuing to take its toll on many agricultural industries, including Australia's wine industry. Now, we export about 20% of our national crop to China, which is worth about $1.3 billion annually. Early reports were that coronavirus had decimated our wine export market into China by up to 90%. As Michael Condon reports, the biggest reduction of wine sales is in restaurants due to widespread quarantine, but online sales may get a long-term boost.
No concrete figures are available yet, but some commentators believe Australian wine exports have been reduced into China by up to 90%. Rabobank's Hayden Higgins says there's been a massive drop, but he's not sure it's that much.
I think talking to people across the various parts of the Australian wine sector, some people are more affected than others, so you're getting varying degrees of impact. But if we look at the export data in terms of alcoholic beverages for January of this year, 2020 v January 19, 2020, that's actually up year on year, and alcohol normally makes up about 85% of that value. So, wine makes up around about 85% of that alcoholic export value. So that would tell you that certainly in January there wasn't a material impact there. But as I say, we probably need to see the stats come out of Wine Australia, which won't come out till April, to see the impact in January, February and March.
So they are expecting a hit, but it may not be as bad as first feared.
Well, it depends where you are, I guess, too. You know, there will be some people who will be feeling a significant impact, and particularly perhaps if they are, say, bulk exporters into China. Not that bulk is a large proportion of the volume. You're definitely going to see it from anyone exporting product up there, because around about a third of all wine sales in China are on-premise sales. So, you know, anyone that's dining out or wanted to dine out has had pretty severe restriction placed on them. So not only impacting wine, but it will be impacting a lot of other ag export products right across the chain into those food service outlets. So that slowdown will naturally flow through back to import demand from China. And you add to that there is already a slowdown in import volumes in 2019 as they were trying to clear existing inventory, as well as a bit of an economic slowdown. So you wrap all those factors together, and this, you know, COVID-19 doesn't come at a very good time, and it is likely to slow it down, no doubt about it. It's hard to quantify the total numbers yet, but we get a sense that perhaps, you know, 90% over the whole market might be a bit high, but it won't be till, as I say, April till we'll be able to get a sense of what that really looks like.
And what about the issue of maybe, you know, like you say, restaurant sales, and they'd be well down because of, you know, quarantine, and I would imagine that would hit the premium wine market.
Definitely, that's correct. So all of that food service channel will have had a big slowdown there, and so if they are looking for stock at all, you're probably looking to draw down on inventory that's already in market. And add to that supply chain disruption in those late January through into February in terms of getting stuff onto ports and off ports and then through the supply chain into the markets has also been problematic and continues to be a challenge.
Marketer and master of wine, Rob Geddes, has been involved in the Chinese market for a number of years, acting on behalf of wine companies, but he's also marketing a new app. He says he's sure that the coronavirus will push more Chinese customers online to buy items like wine, but it was a trend that was happening anyway.
Yes, they've put up these very hygienic barriers. Quarantine is still a powerful social device in China. They're very proud of their achievement in this area. People are not getting together and celebrating the party in the party manner that is typical in China of these very large dinners. So I think right now in China, there is a lot of wine that is undrunk, that would have been drunk on the Lunar New Year. And we're seeing changes in consumer behavior as people are forced to go more online in order to buy. And we're seeing changes also in delivery, where they're expecting delivery to be faster and delivery needs to be safe.
And so I guess you've had a business model, you set up a business model to do that, but it's fortuitous really, considering the virus, because it means less hand-to-hand or person-to-person contact.
The virus has definitely given the business that we are promoting a positive, but the underlying relationship of digital marketing and selling online in China is an area that Australia has lagged in because Australia sells $1.3 billion worth of wine in China, but selling only $300 million in online, whereas France is selling a figure of three times more than that, we see there's a very big opportunity to be able to empower the people in the bush, the people in the countryside who are making wine and selling it, to learn Chinese digital marketing.
And you think that it's been given a fillip by the coronavirus, but it was trending that way anyway.
Yes, Australian wine is going to continue to grow in China because we have the reputation, the location, the time zone, lots of good geographical and social features. The coronavirus is going to change cultures, a lot of consumption culture, away from face-to-face. They will pull out their camera, their phone, they'll put the phone on a product and the link in the phone will take them straight to the sales outlet. They'll be able to price it while you're wearing it. So they are so digitally literate that they will go shopping for the experience. So shopping is a social event where you're there to look good, to have some fun, and the business of buying will be conducted more quietly from home with a lot of referencing.
That is Rob Geddes, Master of Wine and Marketing Consultant to a number of Australian wineries, speaking there to Michael Condon. So what does this all mean for South Australia's wine industry? Because, of course, South Australia is a very important wine-producing state. We're responsible for nearly half of Australia's production and almost 80% of the country's premium wine production. James March is the CEO of the Barossa Grape and Wine Association. Good afternoon, James.
Good afternoon, Isabella.
From people in the wine industry that you've spoken to, what's of the most concern to you currently around the effects coronavirus is having on the industry?
I think the most concern, Isabella, is just the uncertainty around how long this impact will last. At the moment, we're very confident that there'll be a period of which business returns to normal and there'll be an uplift and looking to trade again. It's just a question of the timing of which and how long this period of subdued activity will last.
what are wineries in the Barossa telling you about the effects that they're noticing? We've heard, you know, reports that exports to China could be affected as high as 90%, but what are you hearing locally on the ground?
Locally on the ground, we've heard that, you know, there was a really good period of activity in terms of export sales in the lead up to Chinese New Year. So that was reflected in Wine Australia's export figures up until the end of December, where we had, again, record growth to the China market. But that obviously will be impacted significantly in terms of just reorders. They didn't get the pull through that we would have anticipated with restaurant sales, et cetera, happening in the Chinese New Year. And so that period of February and March, where it would have been likely that the reorders would have started coming in, that they're just they're delayed. And so whether or not it's 90%, it is still a little bit early to tell, but it will have a significant impact.
We've heard from Rabobank about the fact that a third of wine sales to China is through the food service market, which has taken a massive hit because of quarantine. Trade events are also being cancelled or postponed. What are the ongoing ramifications of that?
Well, with the trade shows being deferred or postponed, I think it's, again, coming back to that question of really understanding how long this thing is going to last. We know that Vinexpo Hong Kong, which is a significant trade show for broader Asia, but particularly around Hong Kong, has been pushed back into July. So it's a question of how long do we ride this out in terms of March, April, May, etc. No doubt things will bounce back. We know that the number of cases being reported in China was at a record low. It's now a question of, you know, when is the Chinese business activity, when is the confidence going to return for people to come back into restaurants and be driving those sales again? And one would hope and anticipate that it's a matter of weeks and months. We know that, you know, there's starting signs of activity starting again. I heard from one Barossa exporter recently saying that they've had an order come through. So it's early days, but there are signs that things are just starting to come good.
You've sort of touched on it there. Once this virus has peaked and things return to somewhat normality, how long do you think, if you had to estimate, it will take to recover? Because there'll be a backlog of stock in China to work through as well.
It's a difficult one to plan for, Isabella. The scenario planning and anticipating the future are always fraught. But, you know, if there's one thing that we can be confident of is that the Chinese trade and market and the wineries that support them are all in this together, or are all looking to generate activity and income and get sales back and people gainfully employed and working again. So whether it's a question of weeks or months is difficult to tell, but there's no doubt that it'll you know, things will get back to where they were.
I'm speaking to James March, the CEO of the Barossa Grape and Wine Association. James, tourism has taken a hit as well. What effect have you noticed in terms of wine tourism in the Barossa?
Overall, we're noticing a subdued activity, but is that a cause? I mean, there are a number of elements that could have been behind that, whether there's subdued economic activity and the mood in Australia. We've obviously had the impact of the bushfires, you know, across the country and also in our neighbouring regions. We know that, you know, just the general activity tends to take a sort of a slower period right now. So it's definitely having an impact, but we're working very hard to encourage people to, you know, do the travel domestically, look at opportunities in their own backyard, and support our tourism operators in this time.
Do you have numbers for how much visitors are down over the summer period?
We haven't qualified that as yet, but we're definitely noticing a trend downwards. But in terms of its specific numbers, no, we haven't calculated that to date.
How are you trying to combat that downturn? You mentioned before the importance of the domestic market. What are some of the things you're doing there?
what are the opportunities around sort of building brand awareness and getting the name out there, you know, renewed energy and enthusiasm, looking at collaborative activities. And we ran a dinner down in the Port Adelaide as part of the Wonderwalls Festival last week, showcasing a collection of Barossa chefs all coming together to deliver a fantastic evening. One of the that's part of the overall strategy around launching a new campaign that we've got, the Barossa Find Your Place in Our Story. We're launching a new website with associated digital media to coincide with that. Any activity that we can do to really just get the name out there again. We've got a huge opportunity now with the North-South Expressway or the Northern Connector opening again. So getting that message out to Adelaideans and other people that are arriving from the airport that Barossa is less than an hour away. All of those activities help.
James, thanks so much for your time today.
Been a pleasure. Thanks very much, Isabel.
That's Barossa Grape and Wine Association CEO James March. Up next, you're going to find out what goes into your pet's pet food.
Are you an Indigenous Australian interested in working in the media?
The ABC is committed to growing our First Nations workforce and providing content and services that tell Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander stories.
Right now, there are some exciting new jobs on offer for Indigenous applicants, with roles spanning content making and behind-the-scenes support.
For more information on how you can be part of Australia's most trusted media organisation,
visit abc.net.au/careers.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Lovely to have your company this Tuesday at 14 minutes to one. Now, it can be hard enough trying to think of what to feed your family, let alone what to feed your pets. But that is Mark Torrens's job. As the Director of Strategic Sourcing at Mars Pet Care, it's his job to find ingredients used to feed cats and dogs all over the world. Kath Sullivan met up with Mark and began by asking him to describe his industry.
It's a big industry, which I think a lot of people don't look at. I think in terms from a supermarket point of view, it might be the second or third biggest category behind the alcohol and maybe the baby part. So it's a whole aisle. You walk in, you've got a whole aisle. I mean, from a food point of view that we do, we've probably got half of that aisle. And then you've got all your, like, your collars and your fleas and your litter, etc. as well. So it's a big industry, which I think a lot of people don't quite get.
$10 billion, in fact, here in Australia, you're saying the pet care industry is worth.
Yeah, around 10, 10.4, and of that for the manufactured food where we work in, around 3 to 3.5. So it's quite a sizable part of the supermarket and something that we all use for our pets every day.
What is it that you're actually sourcing?
For us, we'll only use the quality materials that you and I'll eat. So no knackery, no horses, very keen, like they're companion animals. Horse is a companion animal, so we won't use any deceased, any dead animals. So it's all about quality and the standard. You know, any Mars factory around the world, whether it's chocolate or for pet food, it's the same standard. So quality is the ticket of the game for all of us.
As we go into rebuilding phase, we're expecting cattle prices. Well, we're already seeing them at record levels. I'm concerned I'm not going to be able to afford to eat red meat. Are people prepared to pay more for their pets?
Yeah, again, great question. And the market's probably changed a lot. I think 10 years ago, it was probably a lot more bland, is probably not the right word, but a lot more generic offerings. These days, there are many more offerings at all tiers. So there's definitely parts of the consumers that will pay for it. There's definitely parts that just love their pet and want to look after their pet and will price accordingly. And I think these days, the pet food market caters for all those people. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the challenge is there for all of us, though, because the challenge we face is that we're going to tailor the products to suit what everyone wants. Managing the price and the volatility and having the supply to meet that has become a lot harder in the last few years with reduced herds, so there's less offal for us, less grain, so there's going to be less grain to choose from, and that does impact the price going through.
How hard has the drought hit your business?
Yeah, the drought, it's hurt. There's no question about it. I mean, look, this one we're in at the moment has been around for a couple of years. So, I mean, look, the tools are there. We all know it's there. But it's probably the supply chain and the drawing arc's been the hardest. So for where we're based, all of a sudden you're dragging grain or having to drag grain from further afield. So, yeah, the freight component of that, managing the inventory and the stock levels has made it really, really hard. And, again, we're in a business where no one wants to be changing the price on the supermarket shelf every day. So you're trying to maintain a profitable business that grows the local community as well, and maintain your margins over a long period of time. So the volatility we've seen in the last couple of years has made that really more difficult versus what it was 10 years ago.
It feels like a lot of the issues, a lot of the headwinds sort of facing the industry are quite complex, but some are very different to what they were just 12 months ago. So when you talk about volatility, how do you factor that in?
Yeah, it's like I think for the last 2 years, what we're seeing out of China right now is probably what keeps me awake at night. Like the ripple effect with the trade flows we're seeing on the back of coronavirus and even the ASF impact on the Chinese pig herd. We don't use pork direct, but it's that ripple effect. So all of a sudden, you're going to see potentially more poultry grow. We use a lot of poultry for our products. So if the poultry industry starts to change and the value of chicken goes up as well, that's going to impact us as well. It'll impact the feed we use as well. So the more the poultry industry grows, given its value to lamb and beef and pork in Australia, the more grain demand they're going to have as well.
That's Mark Torrens from Mars Petcare, based at Wodonga in Victoria. And we're going to change pace and leave talk about coronavirus for the moment. It is coming up to 1:09. Now, you might get a haircut with scissors, but can you imagine trimming an entire sheep like that? Blade shearing is an alternative to machine shearing, and it's all very skilled work. Bridget Herman caught up with John Daller, an Australian blade shearer champion from the York Peninsula, and Andrew Murray, a New South Wales champion, at the Mundulla Show in the state's southeast to find out a little bit more about this type of wool shearing.
No, it's been a good show. The sheep have been good. Good to shear. The ones we judge are fantastic quality of sheep. And the show's, picturesque. It's a magnificent showground. So.
And Andrew, what about yourself? What brought you to Mundulla?
John did. I came for a bit of a day to have a look at some of the sheep in the area and do the blade demonstrations with John.
John, how does blade shearing differ from machine shearing?
So in Australia, we use the blade shearing for specialised stud sheep, shearing rams and ewes for shows and also the special stud sales. It's for regulation tagging, so all the sheep in Australia are shorn and then assessed to make sure they're all the same length, ready for the show and sale season coming up. And blade shearing leaves a better tip, gets a nice clean cut on the fibre, and we can make them nice and smooth across the top and leave a little bit of wool on so that we're not taking it all off. Whereas machine shearing, you're taking all the wool off, and if you don't shear them early enough, they don't have enough length to be part of that regulation shearing, and then you're a bit disadvantaged throughout the year. And also machine shearing shatters the fibre and takes a little bit of time to recover, whereas sheep that are blade shorn, they keep going ahead and doing well right from the start because they've left that little bit of wool on and the clean cut of the fibre.
Andrew, does the difficulty level change between the two types of shearing?
Marginally, because there's a bit more to think about when you are blade shearing, because you've got to think about the height and where your tips are, the thinking about the different shape of the animal. And, there's always practice. You're going to machine shear more, so you get into a rhythm with that, whereas blade shearing, that only goes for about 2 months of the year. So it's getting into that pattern, really, that makes it easier.
Is it more of an art?
I would say so. It does require more skill, so yes.
The sheep that both of you mentioned seemed really quite calm. John, does your level of calmness change the sheep's level of anxiety, and does that make a difference?
Definitely. You go into it with a bad attitude, and generally the sheep don't sit as well. But there is something about blade shearing. The sheep are a lot calmer. We quite often get guys that machine shear, have never seen blade shearing, and when they do for the first time, can't believe how calm and well the sheep sit. They literally, fall asleep. By the time you finish shearing them, you've got to convince them to stand up because they just get you into a trance. There's no, don't have the vibrations, you don't have the noise, and you work around the sheep. You're not having to turn the sheep in onto a down tube when, like you do machine shearing. You work around the sheep and get it in a little bit more comfortable positions, and they just seem a lot more relaxed.
And Andrew, are certain types of sheep more suited to being shorn by clippers than other types of sheep?
Yes, merinos are more ideal for blade shearing just because they have more wool and it's easier to get a nice smooth job on, as opposed to like a British breed sheep where the fibres are loose and more spread out over the area of the sheep, so it's harder to get a good smooth job on them.
That was New South Wales champion blade shearer Andrew Murray speaking there to Bridget Herman. It is 6 minutes to one. My name's Isabella Pittaway, and we're going to head to the far west of New South Wales where our river watch continues. Last week, the Darling River flows were at Wilcannia, and it's expected the water could reach Menindee this afternoon or tomorrow morning. Greg Martin from Nellagari Station says it was quite a show when the water arrived at his place downstream from Wilcannia.
Yesterday at about 2 o'clock, it was when we first noticed it, and since then it's risen about 3.5 metres, I'm guessing, and it was just roaring past really, really fast. I've never seen it flow that fast.
So you could hear it, could you?
Yeah, I kept checking it every couple of hours because we thought it would probably hit sometime tomorrow, and I was working around the workshop here, and I kept checking it all the time, and we had lunch at about 1:30, and after we'd finished our lunch, could hear the dogs barking, and Lily, my wife, went out to see what was going on because I was actually on the phone, and she yelled out, the water's hit, the dogs were sitting on the edge of the river, looking at it, barking at it because all the noises it was making because it was coming through the dry snags and trees that were in the bottom of the river. And it was a really specky sight to see and hear. But it was only a foot deep in the lowest spot in front of our house, and upstream a couple of bends. It's been totally dry for a couple of months. So, it's... A totally different river this morning to what it was yesterday morning, that's for sure.
So the dogs probably hadn't really seen anything like it, Greg, in a while.
No, they hadn't. No, they would have even. It was one of my oldest, Kelpie. She hadn't seen the river flow like that. No, she obviously was a bit confused. They're sitting in there barking at it.
So you had that rain last week. That would have really kind of lubricated the river there to have that flow come through.
All helped, no doubt about that. So, we've had two good things happen in a week. So, all we need now is some follow-up rain in the next few weeks and for it to continue to rain and have a half-decent season. And we were the lucky ones. There was a lot that missed out and totally, and a lot that only got a little bit of rain. So, we thank our lucky stars we got what we got.
That is Greg Martin speaking there with Georgia Roberts, and we'll have reporters heading to Menindee tomorrow to check out the river flows there. And don't forget, at any time, you can head to abc.net.au/rural for more stories, including an interesting one on the wine industry. There's a company in Perth that has designed a smart bottle cap to counter the counterfeit wine industry. The counterfeit wine trade is now worth up to $70 billion globally. So it's a huge problem, but there's some innovative work happening in Australia to try and counter that. So you can find more on that story at abc.net.au/rural. Sonia Feldoff is on your radio after one. Good afternoon, Sonia.
Hello to you. Well, of course, in fact, in just the last few minutes here in South Australia, our Premier has announced that we will lead the nation in having the very first drive-through coronavirus testing station. What does that mean? Who can go there and what will happen when you do? It's basically you don't even have to get out of your car. You get tested and you can determine whether or not you might be infectious. Hopefully this will be better protecting South Australians from getting coronavirus, but also those who do have it. So we'll find out a little bit more about how that actually works. Obviously, as concerns continue about the coronavirus, a couple of weeks ago we heard the World Health Organization talking about the fact that in a couple of days, it was expected, in a few days, we would hear the announcement of a pandemic. Now, it looks like a pandemic, sounds like a pandemic, seems like a pandemic, but we haven't actually had that declaration. So why are they so reluctant in calling it a pandemic? And what, in fact, would that change if it does? We're going to talk with the security consultant, John Bruni, about that.
I have a feeling the toilet papers, stuff that we've seen probably might have been a cause into not calling it that yet. Goodness knows what would happen after that.
What would happen if we actually did call it a pandemic, given that that's what's happened before? Exactly. So we're going to be talking a little bit more about that. And also on the program today, keeping you up to date with all the scams out there. So keep a listen in to make sure that's front of mind as we take a look at what scams are getting people at the moment.
Great. Thanks, Sonia. Sonia Feldhoff on your radio after 1 or 1.30 across regional South Australia and Broken Hill. That is it for me today. We'll do it all again tomorrow. It is coming up to news time, though, 1 o'clock.
ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
The ABC can be extraordinarily proud that not only did you inform people, you saved lives during this national emergency. Well done.
Hear it via the ABC Listen app.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.